Good evening and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program. I'm your host, David Katzmeier, coming to you live as I do every Thursday night at 8 o'clock p.m. New York time, 5 p.m. Pacific time. Tonight, we have an exciting show about the living organization and social change by author Norman Wolf. Norman Wolf is a recognized expert in changing the way businesses work to create greater impact and to improve the lives of those they serve. He is an active visionary change agent on boards of directors, advisors to CEOs and boards, and a corporate operations leader. Mr. Wolf has led major turnarounds, restructuring and growth initiatives across a wide range of industries. Since 2002, Mr. Wolf has been CEO and chairman of Quantum Leaders Incorporated, a consulting firm committed to changing the way businesses operate. Mr. Wolf asks the question, why do we get the results we get? And how do we as individuals and collectives create the results we desire? This question took him into the exploration of the diverse fields of organization theory, leadership, quantum physics, depth psychology, and the exploration and experience of many spiritual traditions of the world. In his book, The Living Organization is an amalgamation and the refinement of what lies at the core of these different disciplines. It is a robust new model that describes how to work with the forces that create an individual's or an organization's results. At his site, you'll find concepts such as our world seems to be collapsing around us. We see it in government. We see it in educational systems and the business world. While many blame the economic capitalist system, the problem lies not with the system, but with how people use the system. Arthur C. Clarke said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. The world of the living organization breaks the shackles that have bound us to the great machine for more than a century. These concepts and other thought-provoking concepts can be found at thelivingorganization.com. Thelivingorganization.com. And the magic may be, ladies and gentlemen, in understanding that we as a collective are a living organization. We, in effect, are like cells in a great organism, and we are the models of the civilizations we make up. I believe that just as we have biological rhythms within us, so explains that there are tides in the affairs of man, tides in the tides of time. Consequently, we are like DNA molecules of the patterns that have gone before us throughout the eras of civilization. So look to understand us, the patterns within us, and know that these patterns are reflected in things great and small, and you may understand more how to interact with society, a group, or a business as a living organization. It's not a machine. It's more complex than that. But a complexity that we can understand because we are the complexity. Think not of it as a mechanical model. Think of it as a living being, and you will understand more. So here to explain a good deal more about this is author Norman Wolf of thelivingorganization.com. Norman, are you with us?
I sure am, David. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I've been eagerly waiting tonight because you have a concept that I have learned to embrace as I go further with my studies. It all leads more towards the very thing that you espouse in your work. Could you give us an overview about what brought you to write The Living Organization?
Happily, David. I have been, as you pointed out, either leading organizations myself or helping other executives create success in their organizations. And I've been curious a lot about, as you pointed out, what creates success? Why are sometimes success comes to companies in some amazing and almost magical ways? Everybody likes to point to Apple as one example. And yet other companies struggle and it's hard and the results don't come easily at all. I've even found this in my coaching with individuals, the same pattern. And it created a real curiosity for me as to what's going on. Why isn't it easier? Why are we struggling so much? And especially in business, David, if you look over the last three, four decades, we've had an abundance of literature out about how to make organizations more effective, how to change the role of leadership, servant leadership. We have tribal leadership. We have Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Effective People. We have Daniel Pink's book on drive. I mean, you've got a wealth of information going back to the late 60s, early 70s that have flooded the management curriculum. Mm-hmm. And yet, 40 years later, still nothing is happening. Why not? What is preventing all these wonderful ideas from being implemented? And that's when I got locked onto the notion that we're dealing with a paradigm shift, a fundamental change in the way we think about the world. And when you change the way you think about the world, you actually change the world the way it is. And so I began to do a little research around where did the current model come from, and it literally came out of the dominant scientific principles of the early 1900s, late 1800s, which was Newtonian physics. In the beginning of the 1900s, you had people like Frederick Taylor, the father of what we call scientific management. Even the term, we apply the science of the day to management theories. And it was all about reductionism. It's a structure where we look at the world, as Newton did, as a great machine. If you can take the parts, if you can take it apart and piece by piece, put it back together in the sequence you want, we'll be able to understand it, predict it, and control it. And that's been the dominant theme underlying everything we do in business. And that paradigm literally rejects anything that doesn't fit within it. And so all these ideas that came about that told us how to run our organizations more effectively had only small pockets of success, and usually by innovative leaders who were unconsciously breaking the paradigm. They didn't know it and tried to explain their success in the old paradigm, which caused other leaders to try to replicate something that really wasn't happening. And so I sat back and said, okay, well, what's a new paradigm? What's a paradigm that would work in today's much more complex, highly changing, highly global environment? One that allows resilience, responsiveness, growth. And if you look at those components, you're talking about nature. Yeah. How does nature create results? So there you go, the living organization.
Well, I love it. And you're right. We do have an expectation template based on a mechanical model. Well, we're moving away from Newtonian Cartesian, as in the philosophy of Descartes thought, into a more, well, we've learned that looking at the body of the universe, physics, that there is a quantum element. That in quantum physics, we learn that things don't have the boundaries that we thought they had. And in fact, they have a tendency to exist in a certain way until you look at them. Well, right. That changed everything. There goes the mechanical model. And okay, if it doesn't fit in the jigsaw puzzle, we need a new puzzle.
and it emphasizes, and I'm glad you raised that point, because it emphasizes the notion of the observer. In the Newtonian mechanical model, everything is considered objectively observable and objectively knowable. That is, that the world exists out there independent of the observer. And what we know from other sciences now are coming on board, biology, microbiology has proven that, you know, the so-called fixed DNA isn't so fixed anymore, that it actually responds to its environment. So this whole notion that the world is a certain way and all we have to do is observe it and we can control it and predict it has broken down over the last 5 decades. Even longer. And yet the models we have for running our lives, business, banking, education, have not changed. And that's where it gets to your work. I totally believe we're in a shifting wave pattern. There's a fundamental transformation happening. We're crossing a meridian, or we're crossing the zero line here pretty substantially. And so I think it's all coming together, just as your wave theories predict.
Well, I believe that it is. And I'm really excited about the concept that you're bringing forth here, because it helps me to understand my looking at history as moving in waves. And why would there be waves in history? Why wouldn't there just be physical causality, a sequence of events, of cause and effect? Why would there be these underlying patterns in it unless we are in a living organization? And so we used to believe the world was flat. We got out of that. We used to believe we were at the center of the solar system and the center of the galaxy. We got out of that. And now what you're bringing forth is a quantum realization of us as the observer, right? Because the objective observer point is not the center of the universe either.
No, it's not. And the fact that you begin to shift that, now you begin to sense that the world begins to exist based on the observations of the observer. That's a pretty interesting theme. Now, it happens to be pretty well substantiated in a lot of what you might call the mystics of the past, the notion that we create our own world, or even in the more modern a new thought theory of Ernest Holmes and Phineas Quimby, or just the notion of positive mental attitude from Napoleon Hill.
Yes.
The fact that we actually create our reality is a relatively new concept, but it's getting a lot of support by the quantum physics. Now, most physicists who are pure will try to keep away from extrapolating the subatomic world into the physical world that we live in the macro world. But it's hard to resist the correlation, especially like you say, whether you call it a fractal universe or holographic universe. I love what you said. You know, we're organisms inside organisms inside organisms inside organisms inside organisms. Just look at our human body. We've got organs, right, that come together and act in cooperation with each other that allow our bodies to operate. Well, those organisms and those organs are made up of cells.
Yes.
And cells are made up of atoms and, you know, and molecules. And you just, so you've got a pattern that shows repeatedly that you've got living organisms inside living organisms inside living organisms. And it just repeats over and over again.
So in this fractal model of the replication of the universe through things great and small, then we are the models of the civilizations that we make up. So unless that, you know, you're a Ford and I'm a Chevy, we don't live in a mechanical world. The world is a living organization. And that's the breakthrough. Just to begin with that concept allows for so much learning that we would have otherwise rejected.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that to me is the beginning of what the 21st century is going to reveal to us. I'm very hopeful about it. The sad thing from my perspective is history has indicated that there's a collapse before a rebirth, so to speak. There's the death before the resurrection.
Exactly.
That's hard for us who are living in that transition period, which is where our society and our world is actually in right now. And it makes it for a very uncomfortable period for most people. But if you recognize that, you know, not to be too Christian about it, but you know, after the crucifixion comes the resurrection, that gives a little bit of a hopeful feel to it. There is a continuity to the universe. Predicting what it might look like is an interesting challenge. But if you take the notion that we create our world, then predicting it is less important than what is, you know, who was it that said, be the change you want to be? I think it was Gandhi.
It was Gandhi.
If you want to create a world, don't try to predict what it's going to look like. Just create it. Just be that world, and it will begin to unfold that way.
It will. And, you know, just as we were created in the image of the Creator, well, then logically, we create in our own image. And so our nations and the world community is
Absolutely.
Created in our image. Yeah, but the trick
Absolutely.
Is to understand that the patterns and cycles that move within us, well, when you move them through a nation of us, those patterns are going to take much longer to go through.
Mm-hmm.
that's because larger institutions are slower to change. And it's not just Christianity, Mr. Wolf. You know, you look at the temptations and the trials that went on in the life of Siddhartha Gautama and becoming a Buddha and a Krishna. And well, Joseph Campbell said there is only one myth because it's the same story being told over and over again with different players, different languages, and different names.
Even the Islamic tradition, you had Muhammad. You have him going through his trials and tribulations before
he
his revelation. And absolutely. It doesn't matter what religion you go through or what spiritual tradition, what path, or whether it's, as you pointed out, some of the major paradigm shifts in the physical world. You know, the world is flat, now it's round, the earth's in the center, now it revolves around the sun. You know, all these changes are evolutionary waves that happen. And I emphasize the evolutionary nature of it because it is the process of the universe itself evolving. I'm not wise enough to be able to predict where it's going to evolve. I'm only gained enough wisdom to know that it is evolving and we are changing. And so how can we contribute to the next piece of it? And that's where my interests lie.
And I believe to answer that question, well, just in part, the way that we can go on with that is to first realize exactly what you said. That it is changing, that it is evolving, that we're not a center point. There is a subjective element, and there is a quantum transference into the world that we experience. And when we see it in the microcosm, you just have to look at the right level of large and small to find where these same things will manifest, and it happens to be the events of our lives.
Absolutely. And it also explains some of the things we observe in the world. I mean, think about a person who is going through a major transition in their life. The first phase of that, as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross called it, the death process. And I look at change as fundamentally a death process because the reality is when something changes, what was ain't no more. So you're going to be going through a death process of some sort. And the first stage of the death process is denial. It's a fundamental human characteristic to want to keep life the way it is. So what do we have in our society? We've got, for the last three elections, including this one, almost a 50-50 split between part of the population that wants to keep things the way it used to be and another part of the population that recognizes change is inevitable. Let's get on with it. Let's start thinking differently. Let's start acting differently.
Yes.
We don't have all the answers, but let's figure them out. And you see that in, and I don't want to label the Tea Party or liberals or any of that. It's just a human nature dichotomy between I'm afraid of the change and I want the change.
That has been a pattern that's been repeated throughout history. And while it seems to be our own experience, others have had to face the same thing when it was time to change. But when we understand the patterns of change, we may not be threatened by them when they come. You know, as the cycle rises and as it falls, it has to break up into the high half in order to come out of the low, to end the night and begin the energy of the high. But when that's over, it has to break down through the middle back into the low half to bring another night. And in order to do that, it's lights out. And you have to have a point of crisis at each time. So it's part of the pattern that as the cycle is rising and breaking into the new half to begin the life of a new era, you're going to go through a brief transitional crisis in order to bring that in. But this isn't what I want our listeners to understand in such a thing, is that that is merely the birth pangs of a new era. When you hear someone screaming in pain, you know a miracle is about to happen and a new life is coming forth. But at the end of an era, you know, there's something else. There's a time when castles are crumbling and it's time for an era to end and institutions may fall, leaders may fall. But in the process, what we do is we know it's time to breathe, to inhale as well as to exhale and to have a night and reform, go back and take a look at what we've done. Because you know what? There's a yin and a yang. That's life.
And I think your point that these wave cycles are longer, the time periods are longer when you go up in size of collective or the size of the living organization. So when you're dealing on a state level, or you're dealing, it's going to be one level. If you go up to the country level, and then you go up to the planetary level, the
yes.
cycle still exists for these living entities. I love the way you said that, just biorhythms in effect for the living entities, but the longer cycles. And as they become longer cycles, the down cycles take years, as do the up cycles. So
yes.
We go through this period that seems like it's forever on the human scale, right? Because we are we're typically oriented around a day-night cycle, or a monthly cycle, and a yearly cycle, and that's about it. But on the planetary scale, or on a society scale, they're talking about years is a day, decades
right.
a week, right? And it just gets expanded like that. So it's going to be painful. But as
and,
you said,
yes.
there's hope. I mean, there's the miracle of the new thing that's emerging that, you know, you can focus on what's dying, or you can focus on what's being born. Take your pick. I choose to focus on what's being born because it's exciting.
Right now, there's a lot being born because, well, according to my theory, where we are in the cycles of the world, we're coming up out of an intellectual low and emotional low. And these are both crossing up, giving birth pangs at the same time as we go into a new era of romanticism and a new age of reason. But yeah, these are big cycles. You know, when you go all the way up into the observation of the zodiac, which is a cycle of all the ages of, it takes 25,920 years for the precession
yep.
of the equinoxes, having to do with patterns in the wobble of the earth. And there are many scholars throughout the ages that have looked at that half of the signs, six of the signs will be during a daytime, and then half of those signs would be during a nighttime. Well, this mirrors down to a year, because then that's why the month is divided into, the year is divided into 12 months, and that's a fractal relationship, the day and night cycle of the day. So when you just start on that concept in time, as simple as that is, then you can start looking at, if we are living organizations as ourselves, then if we form a business community, it has a life. And there's philosophers that support this. Oswald Spengler said there are
right.
There is a life cycle in civilization itself. It goes through birth and childhood and adulthood and senescence and eventually death. And Italian philosopher Giovanni Battista said there's such a thing as a character of a people. So you can look up at a nation as a collective, your business as a collective, and you start thinking about it that way instead of a well-oiled machine, then you're going to get the results you desire with a deeper understanding. Right, Norman?
Absolutely. And I'll just give you a couple of kind of fun anecdotes. You know, I was talking with a client the other day, and she has this mortgage company. And just for the sake of it, I'll just say, we called the name of the company Rose. And we were talking about, you know, future plans and all that. I said, well, you know, Rose is about 15 years old now, approximately. What do you think Rose wants to do for the next phase of her life? And the CEO stopped and thought and said, you know, I never thought about it from that perspective before. I wonder what Rose does want. Now, that's an interesting, I mean, it's a little bit of a joke, but you think about it, and in my business, I'm collaborating with two other women here in Portland, too. We have this project to create Portland to be a model city for vibrant, alive, exciting places to work. We call it the Juicy Workplace. And as the three of us work together as a collaborative, little company, three people, right? And we're applying the same things. And we'll sit down and talk about what does Juicy want? What does Juicy need to develop? As if Juicy's right now a three-year-old child and needs nurturing from her parents. And so if you can look at the CEO's role in leadership, it's very synonymous to a parent's role. And now everything begins to change. Right? Now I'm worried about the collective's well-being. And I'm looking at the development of the collective. And I want to make sure the collective is healthy. And if you look at it from that perspective, you've got another interesting thing begin to show up. Just like the human body, when I make the human body healthy, all of my cells are healthy.
Yes.
So now let's apply that to the organization. If I make an organization of 1,000 people as a single living entity, a healthy, contributing, alive, vibrant being. I've got 1,000 very healthy, alive, vibrant cells. Well, now I've just, in one fell swoop, improved the lives of 1,000 people. As opposed to the component machine way, you go in and you try to work with each individual component. Yeah, you lose that whole leverage factor. So that's another interesting thing about shifting the way we view the whole purpose of business, view the role of leadership. Those are just a couple of small examples. We can get into a lot more. But changing the framework of how we view the organization fundamentally changes due to the outcome. And you know, I love Joel Barker's statement. He's in the business circles often considered the father or the one who brought paradigms into vogue in the business world in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
He has a statement that goes, what is often difficult, if not impossible, in one paradigm is easy, almost trivial, in another paradigm.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think that's a powerful statement in itself. We're struggling to make businesses successful. We're struggling to create the magic of an Apple. We're trying to get GM to be more effective. I'm watching my alma mater, Hewlett Packard, lose its soul and literally fall out of its iconic class into an almost strand. I don't know if Matt Whitman's going to be able to pull it out. You look at Yahoo. You look at and they all end up falling out of grace, so to speak, when they lose touch with the soulful, what I call the soulful purpose, the very reason for existing. And we try to make them good, effective machines. That's like telling a human being he's an automaton. They're not very effective in life. But you tap into their passion and their joys and their interests and their soulful purpose.
Yes.
You come alive.
And that's going to be more important in this new era that we're moving into. Because we're becoming more emotionally aware.
It's not only more important, it's absolutely critical. Because we cannot respond to life in its much more complex, dynamic fashion if we're not emotionally attuned and even spiritually attuned, and I don't mean religiously, but spiritually, sense of purpose and meaning, what I call context, if we're not contextually attuned and emotionally attuned to what's going on around us, we won't have a chance of navigating the world.
Couldn't agree with you more. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And this is that's very well put, because I believe that's where we're coming out of the automaton era. What I called the machine age was an era in the world which the great physical cycle was high. Well, physical meant powers, guns, and money, the military-industrial complex, might,
right,
makes, right, keep the machine going, get the trains running on time. That is physical. But the machine age is over. It has already crossed down into the lower half in our lifetime. It's going to continue to go down into the lower part where we reform some of the problems and the poisons that we created. All right. So that's what's happening to us physically. So then what happens? Do we have to have a social community? Do we have to feel right in order to do anything? And the answer, thankfully, now is yes. And so we are thinking and feeling beings, and it's so easy to underestimate the power of our thought. Blueprints don't first exist on paper. They first exist in our minds. And if we create these templates and our expectations accordingly, we are going to reject everything that doesn't fit it and be limited by our own thought. But now that we are becoming more interactive, we are learning that there's an interactive process between the individual and the organization. One feeds the other, all for one and one for all. It's a two-way
Absolutely.
Process. And
Absolutely.
All of these things have become so easy. You say that in one paradigm, that which is impossible becomes easy and trivial in another paradigm. Well, doesn't it become, oh my God, it's so simple. It's so easy to understand once we realize that we are building living organizations. Would you treat your pet this way? But you'll treat your business this way.
Right.
So,
That's so well put. I totally agree with you, David.
The new marching orders are don't march.
Well, and it's going to call upon different skill sets, different ways of approaching. You know, It's interesting to me, and I'd like you, you know, to explore this a little bit with you, the notion that we're moving, that the intellectual part is coming up. And I tend to agree with that, but not the intellectual part of the previous age. I believe the intellectual part of the previous age was dominated by what I would call the five senses, an objective reality. This is going to be much more oriented around appreciating subjective reality. And I think beyond the five senses, we're going to be much more involved with what I consider the other two senses, which has been ignored. The sixth sense is what I call the intuitional, yeah. And the seventh sense I call the imaginal. I think so much comes out of our imaginations. You know, you said it a while ago, before the blueprint comes the thought, right? And before the thought comes the image in our brains and the sense of something possible. I love Walt Disney's Imagineering, right? That is so much what I think is the future of the reasoning plane or the reasoning wave that you talk about. So it's not only going to be what we feel, but it's going to be the sense of what do we want to create. That's a much more powerful thing. You know, going back to business for just a second to show you how it applies, I do a lot of work with strategic planning with clients. And, you know, the traditional strategic planning process is you look at the past, you look at your core competencies, you look at the world around you, you assume the future is going to be more or less like it is today, which we know isn't valid anymore, and you sort of extrapolate the future, the past into the future as close as you can. So you just keep building on what you've already done, what you already know. And I show them kind of in a picturesque way. I say, you know, the future's behind me, and I'm looking towards the past, and I'm walking towards the future with my back to it. I said, that's one way to do it. The other way to do it is to turn around. Now, the future, there ain't nothing there. It's a blank slate. What do you want to project on it? What do you want to create? That's what you should be developing your plans around. And again, you can imagine how that changes the whole energy and the whole conversation around what strategic planning is all about. It's much more this creative, imaginal, it's the imagineering notion of Walt Disney that we're going to be calling upon more. Which again, to me, is so much more exciting than, oh yeah, well, we've done that before. That's what I'm good at. And so we're good, just keep doing that. Well, where's the growth, creation, activity, aliveness in doing what you already do so well?
I love it, and that's so well said, because we're coming out of an era of what can we do to what do we want to do, and
Absolutely.
Even what should we do.
That's even more important.
Yeah, so that's an evolutionary step out of coming from survival of the fittest to survival of the wisest. Deepak Chopra believes that that's exactly what we're moving into, and I think that part of that process comes from realizing and respecting the things that we create as being a life form, just as we respect the life of ourselves and each other. And so there's a little emotional intelligence involved with that. There's polarities of thinking. There's win and lose mentality. There's right and wrong mentality. There's correct and incorrect mentality. And you can get, if you focus only on one of those polarities for too long, things come out of balance. But the balance comes, the homeostasis of the undulations of time and change comes, is that all of these things go through different levels of high and low, low and high. Now, as we're breaking into what I will be more than two centuries of reason, of romanticism, emotional intelligence, a rise of feminization throughout the world, you know, and it's not so much that it's going to be male-dominated, female-dominated, is that it's going to be the yin aspect of our lives is going to be integrated into our realization, and more women are going to be choosing leadership roles and so forth, because any society that suppresses its feminine aspects has a tendency towards cruelty. And we've just had 200 years of that. And now, as we start to realize that the things that we create are not machines, but are living organizations that have a heart too, and a mind that we are all contributing to in a collective consciousness, then, you know, William Faulkner, a great author from Mississippi, believed that there are subfields in the collective unconscious of us all, and that groups, certain groups, will have a collective unconscious all of their own. He would have loved to read this book, Living Organization.
I'm sure he would. And, you know, Carl Jung said very similar things about the collective unconscious. And Rupert Sheldrake's work on morphogenic fields has also shown that there's a collective intelligence or collective consciousness, that what the collective does impacts the individual. I've been having some debates with consultant friends and other scholars lately, which is more powerful, the collective or the individual? And coming out of our society, you know, we're really oriented around the rugged individual, the Horatio Alger paradigm, if you will. And that's making this change much more difficult for our society than I think in other societies, perhaps in Europe, Canada, which are much more communal in the basic fabric of their cultural meme, as Don Beck calls it. So the difficulty we're going to have is to recognize that the individual does better as a collective than he does or she does as an individual self. And there's a paradox there that we have to learn to live with. It's the yin and the yang, the apparent opposites, if you look at it as black and white. But if you look at it as undulation of polarities, that you recognize that the collective and the individual support each other in a very synergistic way. But when it comes down to the power of the collective over the individual, we have seen repeatedly, and the simple one I love to use is the recent, a few years ago, London riots. But the notion of mob mentality has been studied by sociologists and psychologists for decades now, and it always has the same pattern. You step into literally an energy field of the mob, and you begin to behave exactly like the mob, even though as an individual you don't. And I love reading the stories in London of, you know, 2 or 3 days after the riots, people returning TV sets and mattresses, and they say, "I don't steal. I don't know. You know, I don't know how this happened." Well, what happened is they stepped into a collective energy field of certain behavior patterns, and they were, quote-unquote, caught up in it. Well, just imagine stepping into an energy field of an organization. The minute you step into that through those hallowed doors of this particular company or that company, they all have their own energy patterns, their own cultural norms, their own values, their own agreed-upon conventions of how you behave here, and you will begin to behave that way whether you know it or not, unless you're really super, super conscious of your own self in relationship to the collective. So, again, just, as you point out, they're just energy patterns.
Yes, yes. And you can't underestimate the influence of the group on us. Tennyson remarked, "So careful, when speaking of nature, so careful of the type she seems, so careless of the single life." So the type will remain. The type is a thing. The type is a life.
Right.
And we are the cells. But each of us as a cell is a life too. So here we are at the microcosm and the microcosm, reminding us again that once we understand ourselves and have the respect and the compassion for each other, we will know how to recognize the elements of the businesses we build and not let them fail, because we'll treat them as lives, not as machines.
Right, we'll treat them as, you know, CEOs will treat them as their children that they're developing, that they cherish dearly, not as a mechanism to, and I don't want to talk about greed of CEOs, I'm not buying into that, but as a mechanism for the bonus. You know, when an organization comes together, and you look at the entrepreneur and the founder, those days of an organization's life are really vibrant. Because the founder of the organization had a desire to impact society in some positive way. They saw a challenge. They saw a problem. They saw a need that, you know, if I could fix this problem, people's lives would be so much easier. There's a company up here in Portland called G Diapers. Two parents who were just giving birth to children, and they were faced with, you know, Pampers or diapers, and there were benefits of one over the other, and they came up with this new model, which now there's about three or four companies doing it, which is kind of a combination of the old diaper system but the Pampers system, making it easier, and you can get the best of both worlds. The problem they saw out of their own lives, and they have a very successful company up here, that's the entrepreneurial spirit. That's what we love to do. But then when the company grows and we begin to try to make it efficient and control it, we begin to squeeze its very life out of it. My wife's an artist, the wings of the butterfly. Absolutely. my wife's an artist, and you know, she does art not for a living. She does it as an expression of her soul. And there was a period of time when we talked about her doing her work, and there's a couple of very famous artists. I don't want to cite them because they're still very popular. But I look at their early work before they became successful, and there was a certain aliveness to it. And then they became highly efficient, and they got other people to paint their style, and they were very replicatable, and they were scalable, and, you know, all the things we look for in business, right? And the whole process was streamlined, except the spirit of their art died.
Yes.
They're selling their name. They're not selling their gift to the world. And I began to observe that, and I drew the same correlation to businesses. You know, we start businesses with this wonderful spirit, this soulful reason they exist, and it's to make a difference in the world. And then we apply the machine paradigm to it, and it's all about making them efficient, streamlining it, make it scalable, and we focus on process improvement and efficiencies, and all of a sudden the machine has taken over, and the very spirit of the human soul is minimized, and so what you create is automatons, as we spoke about earlier. So this is the challenge we've had, and I want to say, I talk about the future in these terms, but I also want to honor the past. Look, back in the 1900s, this model was created. First, we only understood the universe in a certain way. We didn't have the knowledge we have today. Secondly, the way the world worked back then, the kind of labor we had, the complexity of the dynamic. I built a business back in 1900 focused around my local community. I knew everybody. You know, if I got really successful, it was national. Right? It wasn't global. I didn't do a lot of outsourcing. So the model, it's almost like, you know, back in the 1900s we had the Model T Ford. Nobody spent a lot of time building, worrying about wind drag and aerodynamic design. At 30 miles an hour, who cared?
Right.
So all these new dynamic forces we're talking about, back in the 1900s, who cared? They didn't impact you. But today, they have a big impact. And that's why it's important now to wake up to these changes and begin to rethink the paradigm.
Well, I'm convinced that the difference between sunrise businesses from sunset businesses is understanding exactly what you're saying. And we have both going on right now in the great transition of the world. I mean, the world is flat. We're not as territorial, nationalistic. We don't have boundaries like we did before. We got a free exchange across open boundaries, and everything that we do is on a global scale. And never before have we seen such a factor where what's happening globally is going to affect us regionally. But that is clearly a trend. The changes we've seen in that direction are nothing but a bellwether of what's going to be the great pattern throughout. So we are becoming a world community, not just with the social networks and our handheld devices where we can instantly communicate with anyone in the world in the twinkling of an eye. So in what you're talking about, the living organization, you know, to understand this, you have to get it. It's like getting a joke. You either get it or you don't, but you make it so easy to get, because I have so many aha moments. And there was a Baba Ram Dass who said the theory of aha, you make it so easy, you know, and the living organization your book and the website by the same name, The Living Organization, is telling us about this work that I understand is doing very well on Amazon. Could you tell us a little bit on how you laid this book out, Lauren? Because I know you're an advisor to CEOs and to boards of directors, and this is experiential. You're not all theory and no practice. You have walked the walk. You've made this work. You've put it into practice, and now you're turning around to give the rest of us the benefit of your experience by laying it out in this book so that we can go, aha, and get it too. So how did you lay out your book, Living Organization? Tell us a little bit about it.
Thank you. Thank you, David, for the opportunity to do that. So when I started to craft the book, I had all these ideas, and of course, you know, a book has to have some sort of a storyline to it to make it readable and understandable. And while I have studied, as you said at the very beginning, a lot of different traditions from psychology to spiritual traditions to leadership, and I've been a leader, organizational theory, I was looking for some common ground that would tie it all together. And maybe it's my scientific background. You know, I was trained as a mathematician, worked as an engineer, played with, you know, worked in computer science. I have this orientation to almost think scientific method. Excuse me. And so I began to say, what ties all this together? And the one thing I came up with was the notion of energy. And energies, the waves are part and particles. We know that now from quantum physics. Energies have patterns. Patterns like, you know, I think I used an example in the book. Think of patterns of life like clouds. You know, the patterns of energy that come and go, flow in, flow out. And then I said, okay, so if everything is energy, how do you apply that to business? Where does the energy of business really come from? It doesn't come from the electric grid. It really comes from the people. It comes from the contribution of people's efforts on one level, and I'll get to other levels in just a second. And so you got these people contributing their energy. That's where the energy comes from in the journey from idea to product. And so you got these people contributing their energy. Now, of course, if you put a whole bunch of people in the room running around in circles, you're going to get a lot of energy contributed, but you're not going to get a lot done, right? So you need to guide that energy like energy waveguides, like laser waveguides, right? That guide the energy and focus it. So in laser technology, you've got these energy waveguides that take that fused light and focus it, narrow the beam down to what we now call laser-like focus towards an end goal. So I said, okay, well, so you've got people contributing energy guided by a process producing goods and services. And that's the basic model. And that's still true. That's never going to change, whether it's a machine or a living organization. The difference came about when I began to look at energy as this flow of energy passing through a prism, and I identified two other fields. I like to keep it to three. It's easier to understand. And I said, you know, there are three fields of energy flowing continuously through this transformational pathway. And those three fields are activity, relationship, and context. They're just my terms.
The third one again, please, Norm. What was the third one?
Context. Activity, relationship, and context. And just to give you a quick understanding, activity we understand. That's the machine. That's what we do, how we do it. Relationships is the exchange of energy between entities, right? It's between the synapses of the brain. It's an exchange of energy. That's a relationship that's going
emotional.
On. You know, between you and me right now, there's an exchange of energy going on in our conversation, and even beyond our conversation, even beyond our words, just between us. And people can feel that. You get people in the room and you can feel, you know, we call it, you know, when you got a team working like that, it's a high-performance team or synergy, 2 + 2 = 5, that kind of thing. So that's relationship energy. And the third field of energy is what I call context, the field of meaning and purpose, the why we do what we do. And that begins to tap us into what I call the spiritual domain.
Yeah.
the field of something meaningful where the soul lies. You know, if you look at a human being, we got our physiology. That's our activity field. Mm-hmm. That's the mechanics of the body. We've got our relationship field. You might call that the emotional field.
Yeah.
But we've got this other field of energy within us that flows through us, and I call it context. The religious would call it the soul. You can name it lots of different things. In Hinduism, it's called the Atman.
The Atman. Yes.
There's this part of us that animates us. It gives us our core reason for existing. It's the acorn that comes into the oak tree, right? So we as humans, we know we're more than just our physiology. Western medicine today is acknowledging that, you know, our health of our body is as much as our mind, body, and spirit as it is the body.
Yes.
So why not apply that to organizations?
And you so mean it's a good idea to use our heads?
It's a good idea to use our heads. It's a good idea to use our hearts.
Yeah.
It's a good idea to use our, you know, love is a great energy field that really energizes a lot of people. Love in business is not a bad thing, I can tell you that. As a matter of fact, there's a book called Firms of Endearment written by a friend of mine, Raj Sasodia, and a couple of his co-authors. And he calls it Firms of Endearment because what he found is firms who truly care about their people and their stakeholders outperform the S&P 500 by a factor of 10 to 1.
And that's going to increase as this century moves on, I believe, Norman.
Absolutely.
Because we're more that way.
So that was the basic design of the book, was to communicate to CEOs predominantly, but anybody in any organization, any leader of any organization, how they actually manifest results and the importance of these fields of energy, I like to call them. And then the rest of the book explains a little bit about, okay, how do you apply this? I have a section, a couple of chapters in the book that talk about how do you apply this from a strategic planning point of view and stuff like that. And I'm actively working now on a whole bunch of other books and, like, how do you hire for the living organization? How do you do sales for the living organization? How do you do marketing for the living organization? What I call the organization building blocks, right? We can't talk about this at the highest level and then have the poor CEO go back and try to improve revenue and all he has is a machine paradigm process for sales.
Yes.
So I got to give him a living organization paradigm methodology for selling, for marketing, for lean, for agile, for all these tools or building blocks, I call them, that they currently need for the organizations. We got to redesign them all. So that's my current activity.
Well, what I like about this work, Norm, is that it gives us so many ideas to think about, and it gives you great concepts to put in your tool chest and a lot of how-to in here. But a lot of it, and the reason why I want you, ladies and gentlemen, to get the Living Organization is because what it does, it addresses things that you may already know. We all have this intuition. We all have a feeling about things. And then somebody come along and say, you know, this is how I see things. And they go, somebody else will say, I hope so. I felt that way for a long time. But they're not sure that that's the way everyone else feels. Well, you know, the way everyone else feels right now in this transitional period of time, they feel like they hope that everyone is feeling it's important how everyone else feels.
Right.
It will give support to what you already intuitively know so that you will put that into action. The message here is that's the difference between the sunrise and the sunset companies. That's the difference between having emotional intelligence and finally or having somebody come up and tell you, well, buddy, if you don't know, I'm certainly not going to tell you because you're not. Let yourself be supported to realize that you already probably have some intuitive recognition of really of how systems work because they work like we do, and then go on and get the ideas that have been developed from somebody who's been an awakened being and get the how to and get the tools conceptually to put in how to put it into play. That's the difference between hoping it's true, realizing it's true, and then putting it into action. That's the work, the Living Organization, and what it's done for me as I've read it.
I want to thank you for saying that, and I want to highlight a couple of examples. John Mackey, the co-CEO of Whole Foods, was gracious enough to write the foreword. And he said, you know, Norman, you've captured for me what I've done intuitively and instinctually, but I could never really explain it. And and that's one example. I ran into a woman here, Renee Spears of Rose City Mortgage, who has been voted repeatedly year after year the best place to work, the best female CEO in Portland, the best company to work for. And all the awards that are given out, she invariably is in the top 10 or if not the number one. And when she read the book, she said to me, Norman, you nailed it. You know, a lot of people come to me and ask, how do I do it? They want to replicate what I do. And I can never tell them. Now I say, go read Norman's book. He's explained. I don't know what I've done. I just did it, right? It makes sense to me. But if you want to understand it, go read Norman's book.
Well, there has to be a certain art in writing something like this, because the way that we explain the inexplicable to ourselves is to invoke recognition that can be coined to others. And then when the we can talk about a painting that's hanging on the wall and say, well, it's a great pattern, it's the way they put the strokes in there. It's a remarkable way, the way he used to blend his oils and everything. But really, that all those mechanics aside, which are very important and very essential, really makes a piece of painting work or a piece of poetry work or a musical composition work is when the viewer, the listener, experiences what the artist felt when he was putting that into it. And so really this is a window to the world and a mirror to our souls when you realize that we are the organizations that we make up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to that point, I can tell you that when I started to write the book, I started to do it from my head. By the time I was the book took me about 4.5 years to finally get published from when I started. About 2 years into it, I no longer was in control. That book was writing itself. I was just almost a channel for something that wanted to come through me. I was gifted to have the experiences. I was blessed with certain ways of thinking and putting patterns together. But that book is not, it comes from someplace really deep, and I don't know if you want to call it God or the universe or the life force or whatever, but that book was, because I remember that, you know, I kept saying I'm going to finish it next quarter. And every time I tried to think it was finished, there was more coming through. It just kept coming through and coming through. My partners at the time were getting frustrated with me. When are you going to publish the book? When are you going to get it out? And then I remember it was a Monday, one day in May at noon, I finished typing on the book again, and that feeling was, it is now complete.
And you just
I don't know why it was complete then. It just was. So I think you're right. I think there's something from the soul that the artist brings forward, and I feel that about this book, and I hope others get the same feeling. It sounds like you have, and I really appreciate that, David. It's rewarding for an artist when somebody sees it and feels the soul of what the artist was feeling.
That's where it's at, baby. So you're telling me the book took on a life of its own, pun intended.
So. Absolutely. Hey, thank you for that. Yes, absolutely.
Well, we're going into the final 90 seconds of the show, and I think that we're seeing that we can see our own image, not only in the things that we create with our hands, the things that we build, the machines, the artworks that we do, but in the very institutions that, you know, the museum is built by a group of people that put that organization together, and that's a living organization too. It's replete for all around us. So in our closing message here, Norm, in our final 1 minute, what would you like people to remember of all the things we mentioned in this last hour?
Well, I think two things. One is don't be afraid of today. It's a change. Look towards the future. It's. I love the way you said it. We're in the birthing pains right now, and we're yelling and screaming and we're shrieking with pain. And soon the baby will come out. And all we'll know is the beauty and the love and the delight of this new child we call our new society that we're going to be born into. Start looking, and so the second thing is, as you've talked, everything is energy. It's all patterns. It's waves. And we are creative beings, and start seeing life from the vantage point of a creative being, manifesting a world if you want to see. And I guess the third one is look at everything in life, all your organizations, whatever collective group you're part of. See it as a living being. See it as a child you're growing and developing, nurturing, and helping through life. And if you've got a mature organization, then see yourself as the wise sage who's taking it from young adult into maturity, or from maturity into elderhood, and let it continue to make its contribution into life.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there you are, ladies and gentlemen. From simplicity comes complexity. That is the nature of the universe and all of nature itself. And the simplicity is we are building living organizations, and we live in them, we create them, we are them. Thank you so much, Norman Wolf, and telling us about your book, The Living Organization, that you can find at thelivingorganization.com. I'm David Katzmeyer, signing out from Cycles Radio, the Cycles of Change radio program coming to you on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you for listening. Good night.